Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we're talking about cybersecurity on the continent. Five countries are leading the index that rates best practices. We'll be discussing which ones they are and what they're doing right.
They are all giants in terms of international cooperation and putting out best practices. Something else they are doing is investing in digital capacity of youths in particular, because where you look at regions where youth capacity in digital development is not there, there's usually an increase in cyber criminal activity in such areas.
And why is Hungary, a relatively small country in Central Europe, sending troops to Chad in the Sahel? It's Friday, the 20th of September. First, we go to Nigeria. Take a listen to this. It's the sound of water. A lot of water. And it's water being released from the Lakdo Dam in Cameroon. Millions upon millions of litres of the life-giving stuff is pouring down in a raging torrent. Onlookers are watching in amazement. This is not an accident, and it's not a drill. It's a necessity for the Cameroonian authorities to preserve the integrity of the dam when there are floods. The problem is that this release can lead to life-threatening floods downstream, and in this case, downstream means in a neighbouring country, Nigeria. People there have lived through this in previous years, and it's an experience they'd rather not live through again.
We pray there will be no floods this year, because last year when it flooded, we suffered. We went to our neighbor's house, but after a while, that house also got flooded.
We understand that the flood is coming again. Last time flood, many people were suffering, no place to stay, no food to eat. The whole community was flooded. No hope. People lose hope because they thought a flood will never go again, due to the way the flood was rising.
Those voices there from Nigeria. The government of Nigeria has just issued a warning to millions of people who live in 11 states directly in the path of the waters that, due to heavy rains in the region, Cameroon has alerted them to the possibility that it might need to open the floodgates. From what we've just heard, people appear to be helpless in the face of the consequences of this action by Cameroon. Surely that can't be right. Why would Cameroon be allowed to do this? Seems like Nigeria missed a step in the process. Philip Jakpor is an environmentalist in Nigeria, and he's been answering some of these burning questions.
We're going to start with Cameroon. Why does the government need to release water from the dam?
We've been having unusually heavy rains in that region, northern Cameroon and northern Nigeria. Now you have the Lakdo Dam in Cameroon, which services farmers for irrigation and other purposes. But Cameroon is upland and Nigeria is lowland. So once the waters in the dam, due to the heavy rains, reaches a certain threshold, the waters will have to be released to avoid the catastrophic breakdown of the dam. But Nigeria was supposed to build what they call buffer dam to assimilate, like a backstop, from the flow of water from the Lakdo Dam, which we have not done. And that's where the catastrophe usually comes from.
And how long since Nigeria was meant to have built this dam?
I think Nigeria was supposed to have built this dam around 1979 or 1981. So that's over 40 years now. And Nigeria has not done anything about it.
Now, building a dam takes a long time. So since 1979, 1980, the dam has still not yet been built. Successive governments have come and gone. Why has Nigeria not built this dam? Because it's clearly absolutely necessary for the people who live in the area and for Cameroon as well.
Well, you said something, building the dam takes some time, but we are talking about over 40 years now. I don't think Nigeria lacks the resources to build a dam, but I don't think the Nigerian authorities have grasped the importance and the necessity of building this dam, because for years we've not really addressed the climate crisis, which is escalating as we speak. So suddenly the impacts are getting more. Year in, year out, images of communities underwater, the impact on food security is being felt. Now the authorities are gradually waking up. But then nothing has been said of the Dasin Hausa Dam, which Nigeria was supposed to build. And civil society groups, organizations like us, the Renewable Development Initiative, have been raising the alarm that the crisis that we're experiencing, the floodings are completely avoidable. All Nigeria will need to do is build the Dasin Hausa Dam like it was supposed to do since 1979, and then we will not have this much waters. Water is supposed to be a blessing, not a curse. The waters can be used for, you know, other purposes. But now the people see water as a curse. So once the clouds change, they just feel that disaster is coming. And these things are completely avoidable if the Nigerian government does what it is supposed to do in terms of building the Dasin Hausa Dam to assimilate waters once the waters from the Lado Dam is released.
I'm failing to understand why the Nigerian government has not built this dam and why it's not being held accountable for not having built the dam. Just give us an idea of the mind of the Nigerian state that has made them resistant to building this dam. And, you know, I don't understand it. And I think our listeners are also wondering, why would you not do this?
Well, I think the same sense of loss that you are feeling, that why can't they just do this thing and save people these disasters? That is the same feeling we have. Some people have to be held to account. Some people have to take responsibility. Some jobs have to be lost for not doing what they are supposed to do. And some people have to be arrested for not doing what they are supposed to do, because it is the responsibility of the Ministry of Water Resources, for instance, to ensure that this dam is built so that these disasters can be avoided. The reason why this ineptitude on the part of public officials, those who are supposed to build a dam and have not done it, the reason why this continues is because we have not heard the government sanction anyone for all these years of flooding that are completely avoidable. That is where the problem is.
How do you think it affects Cameroon's decision-making? If they know that there's no dam on the other side and people's lives are going to be devastated, does that affect whether they let the water through into Nigeria or not?
Cameroon's business is notifying Nigeria before the waters are released. The agreement when the Lado Dam was built was that Nigeria was also supposed to build a buffer dam. So there was an agreement. The Cameroonians have fulfilled their part of the agreement. The Nigerian part of the agreement is what has not been fulfilled. So it's not the problem of the Cameroonians. But they will not allow their dam to burst. So it's not their problem. It is our problem.
But do you think it affects the decision-making? Because they know what's going to happen in Nigeria to people on that side.
Well, one thing that has improved is that now they alert the Nigerian authorities. In this case, the alert we got is that in 7 days' time, they'll start releasing waters. So they have done what they are supposed to do. There was an agreement for us to build our own buffer dam. We have not built it. It's not that we are lacking the financial resources to do it. It's not that we lack the manpower. It's just people in government who don't see the future, who don't see the seriousness of these things. And for disaster capitalists who believe, oh, if this happens, okay, maybe an opportunity for them to get some palliatives to share to people and divert some. It boils down to corruption on the long run. Why should Nigeria's parliament, who has debated it once, why can't they take action? As it is today, ask the average Nigerian, we don't know the status of the Dasin Hausa Dam, which is supposed to be the buffer dam. Maybe this time around, because the Minister of Water Resources came out this time around to see that the Cameroonian authorities have notified the Nigerian side that they're going to reuse water. This is the first time we are going to be hearing it. It had never happened before. Last year, 2023, the waters had been released in Cameroon. It was 7 days after that they notified the Nigerian side. But this time around, it's the other way around. They've notified Nigeria that in 7 days' time, it's going to be released. So that is an improvement. Our improvement on our side that the Minister of Water Resources was able to come out now and say this is what's going to happen. So this is the first time it is happening. It has never happened before.
And did he say anything about what they're going to do for the people who are going to have to move?
All he said was that the states should prepare to evacuate their people. That's all. nothing else. 11 states are going to suffer for this. 11 states out of 36 states. So it's not, of course, he has come out to say this is going to happen, but there has not been anything concrete in terms of what will happen to people who live in those areas. Those people have only been told to evacuate.
And how many people, more or less, are we talking about?
Oh, you are talking about millions of people. You are talking about nearly 20, 30 million people. That's what we're talking about here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Jagpo, an environmentalist in Nigeria. Every once in a while, you hear of a massive cybersecurity attack. It could be a data leak, hacking of a system that runs a government service, or even breaches of privacy on your own data on your device. It's something we can't ignore. The more technology advances, the more we become exposed to these threats. Sometimes all it takes is clicking on a link online. Countries around the world have had to build legal and actual defenses so that we can operate with security in digital spaces. Several African countries are leading by example, according to the Global Cybersecurity Index. It shows that Mauritius, Kenya, Ghana, Tanzania, and Rwanda are global role models on how to keep people and institutions safe digitally. To help us understand the dynamics of cybersecurity in Africa, we called upon Nena Ifian Ajufo, a professor of law and technology at Leeds Beckett University and vice chairperson of the African Union Cybersecurity Experts Group. Okay, so when we talk about cybersecurity, what do we actually mean?
Cybersecurity focuses on protecting networks, if you like, devices, and even data from unauthorized or criminal use, but also on that emergent relationship between countries when you think about cybersecurity governance and cybercrime. So sometimes you look at cybersecurity emerging solely from a cybercriminal perspective, but also, you know, the regulations, the national security part of it, the international cooperation between countries, the treaties, the laws, and even the socio-legal aspects of it all, you know, focus on cybersecurity and making the internet safe for everyone.
So the Global Cybersecurity Index by the International Telecommunication Union has ranked countries. So when they do that ranking, what are they looking at? What scores high and what doesn't?
So this is not the first time the ITU is doing that index. And generally, it's usually focused on five strategic issues. They look at regulation, which is the legal measures. Then they also look at technical aspects, which also looks at like infrastructure, the digital equipment required to sustain the security of cyberspace and cyber resilience. They look at organizational capacity, for example, the institutions that are there, the authorities that are there ensuring cybersecurity. They look at capacity development, how well a country is developing itself to be resilient to cyber threats. They also look at cooperation. So five of them, they look at legal, technical, organizational, capacity development, and cooperation.
So five African countries performed really well this year: Mauritius, Kenya, Ghana, Tanzania, and Rwanda. So what are they doing right?
I will start off with Mauritius to say what Mauritius is actually doing well. Interestingly, Mauritius is ranked in all of the categories as doing well in all of them. Mauritius may come across as that sort of small country, but I think Mauritius is our biggest cybersecurity export. Since far back, Mauritius has focused on a legal framework. Mauritius is one African country that has ratified the Malabo Convention, which is the African Union Convention on Cybersecurity and Personal Data Protection. It has also ratified the Cybercrime Convention, which is the Budapest Convention. Mauritius is known as the huge and best country with the computer emergency response team. So they have a near perfect, strong computer emergency response team. In terms of organizational capacity, they have all the right authorities, 247 points of contact, technical ability. Even before now, we used to call Mauritius the digital hub of Africa. And so all of those things add value. But interestingly, if you look at a country like Ghana, while, you know, there are aspects, Ghana meets all the aspects, but, you know, falls short on one of them. But then Ghana has a multi-stakeholder approach to cybersecurity. And this is interesting, cutting back to the question you've asked earlier as to what is cybersecurity. Ghana understands that cybersecurity is not just about crime, but also a people-centered approach, vulnerabilities, weaknesses, how to protect people. And so it takes a multi-stakeholder approach where non-militarized approach to cyber security is adopted. So you have the banks involved, you have the institutions involved, you have schools involved in cybersecurity. They involve everyone in making decisions. These countries also have something in common, which is cooperation. Kenya, Mauritius, Rwanda, they are all giants in terms of international cooperation and putting out best practices. And that is something very, very important for the region, because cybercrime is not tied to any geographically proximate location. Something else they are doing is investing in digital capacity of youths in particular.
So what about the countries that didn't perform very well? Burundi, Central African Republic, Eritrea, Guinea-Bissau. What are they needing to improve?
Cybersecurity is a social dilemma issue. It's not just a criminal issue. And the problem is, in many parts of Africa, you have conflicts. And so there is usually a focus on the seen issue rather than the unseen issue. You know, some of these countries you've highlighted, they do not have the adequate laws, the adequate legal measures to address these issues. In some of these countries you've mentioned, there is a lack of infrastructure to effectively counter cyber crimes at international standards, at global best practices. There's a lack of prioritization. So all these countries, based on my research, they don't even prioritize cyber crime. Central African Republic, for example, it's not, you know, seen as an issue. So it allows for that loophole for people to take advantage of such places. There is also that imbalance where you have capacity, laws, and all of that.
So what are the topmost concerns or threats to cybersecurity on the continent? And I know that, as you said, it's not confined to a geographic location, but there might be specific concerns arising out of conditions on the continent.
There are quite a lot of them. I don't know if on the news about 3 weeks ago, Interpol made an arrest, over 300 arrests from the West African region, a group called Black Axe. And Interpol was saying that the rate of cybercrime emanating from the West African region is alarming. And you see that the huge concerns, there are actually many of them. You can't even particularly single out one. Ransomware is a huge issue in the continent now. And that is because of the style of operation for ransomware activities, where a young person or anyone can go to a shop. It's like going to a shop. You buy this tool and you deploy it yourself. You do not need technical expertise. There is also huge influx of commercially available spyware in the region. Hacking is there, financial frauds are there, child pornography, online child sexual exploitation has become a huge market in the African region, a lot of them. And that ties back to this concerns about lack of effective legal framework, lack of effective law enforcement capabilities to address these issues. The 419 scam, the romance scam, the, you know, online fraud. We're having sextortion on the increase, and it's actually a huge concern. Sextortion has become a huge concern, and it's one of the things on the Ghanaian cybersecurity agenda, for example.
Now, you are the vice chairperson of the African Union Cybersecurity Experts Group, which gladdens my heart, because I want to ask, how much of a priority is cybersecurity on the continent, given that countries operate at different levels, for instance, of digitization, have different socioeconomic circumstances, have different political systems?
Absolutely. Now, first of all, I want to highlight that the dynamic with the African Union is quite different from other regional groups. For example, the European Union would make decisions, regulatory decisions, substantive decisions for member states. It is not the same with the African Union. The African Union cannot encroach into the sovereignty of African states. But the African Union itself has prioritized cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is a cross-cutting theme of the Digital Transformation Agenda 2020-2030. Cybersecurity is also a flagship project of the AU 2063 agenda, which is why the African Union Cybersecurity Group was created. So when we were given the mandate in 2019, the main focus was to enhance cybersecurity in the region. So if you know, for example, the African Union has the Malabo Convention, African Union Cybersecurity and Personal Data Protection Convention. Now, like you pointed out, it is actually very disheartening that only 15 African countries out of the 55 African countries have ratified this convention, which touches back on your point about the fact that countries do whatever they want. They have their individual agenda, so you can't force them to ratify. Meanwhile, that convention provides a platform for many people. There are also political reasons, for example, countries who understand internet shutdowns as cybersecurity, which is affecting the economy in many parts of Africa. Sometimes it affects youth involvement. You also can't particularly tell them you can't do this because they have their own individualized agenda, political independence, sovereignty.
You were just mentioning there are many African countries and the tendency they have to militarize cyberspace by internet shutdowns and blocking of certain services like social media platforms and so on, especially during times of social unrest. When countries do that, are they breaking international laws?
Yes, I would say it clearly. Yes. Yes, it is a question of not just understanding, awareness, and what we understand as our obligations under international law. It is clear now that access to the internet is embedded in the right to freedom of information, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And so shutting down the internet arbitrarily would actually be a breach of human rights obligations and international law obligations of states. But now there are aspects to look at it. So, for example, we agree that the internet can exacerbate tensions during conflicts, during wars. If you think about the Rwanda genocide and how telecommunication was a tool through hate speech, we can also reflect on that in present times. But we also have to be clear on why we shut down internet. You can't say you must do good even if the heavens will fall. So it's a case of categorizing why internet is shut down. Remember, human rights are not absolute. So even the freedom of information can be taken away in certain instances like public emergency. But when it is not necessary, when it is not proportional, when it is not based on a legitimate aim, then internet shutdown, like you put it, is against international law. It totally breaches international law, and states should not shut down the internet arbitrarily for no reason.
Nena Ifeanyi Ajufo, a professor of law and technology at Leeds Beckett University. She's also vice chairperson of the African Union Cybersecurity Experts Group. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Rising temperatures,
the extreme weather,
melting ice,
they're all interconnected.
How can we solve this?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring why we find it so hard to save our own planet.
We have many of the tools that we need.
And how we might change that.
If we do smart things right now, we can take care of our descendants.
It is a question of awareness. It is a question of information and access to that information.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
It is based on experience and it is based on science.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And now to the Sahel, a region that generates a lot of coverage in the news, being as it is a hotspot for insurgency, instability, and insecurity. It is also a region rich in essential and rare minerals like lithium, gold, bauxite, and uranium. In recent years, it has been the focal point for geopolitical competition between Eastern and Western interests. Russia, China, the US, and France have been particularly active in the Sahel. Enter Hungary, a smallish, landlocked Central European country, which is set to deploy about 200 soldiers to Chad. Hungary, a member of the European Union, is way smaller than Chad and not particularly well known in relation to other members of the EU or NATO. So why send troops to Chad? Budapest says it is to help N'Djamena fight terrorism and to provide humanitarian assistance. Nosmot Badamosi is Africa brief writer for Foreign Policy magazine, and she thinks there's a bit more to it than that.
Hungary usually works within the European Union when it comes to sort of peacekeeping deals. This time it's going it alone. It's such a small country, it's got a population of 10 million. So to be striking a military deal with Chad is very unusual indeed.
So the Hungarian parliament okayed this deal in November last year. On what basis are they thinking, or did they do it? What's the official reason why they're going into Chad?
Well, the official reason is supposedly to fight terrorism and illegal migration to Europe. They are there officially to train and advise Chadian troops in order to kind of maintain security and stop so much migration coming from the Sahel to Europe.
But everybody and their uncle in Europe has been doing this for the last however many years. It hasn't worked. How affected is Hungary really by migration into Europe? I can't imagine that many people go to Hungary. I know it was used to be one of the through routes, but is their interest that specific?
Not via, from Africa, not via that route. There are not many Africans going via the Sahel that, you know, will be coming through Hungary. What's also kind of strange about the deal is that it's for 200 troops to a country that is, you know, twice the size of France. It's nearly 14 times larger than Hungary. So 200 troops will just simply not suffice in that type of border force.
So what's going on, actually?
There's reason to believe that Viktor Orban, the Hungarian prime minister, is attempting to sort of use the same strategy as Russia in terms of using these small security deals, not only to facilitate critical minerals deals, but also to kind of gain influence on the continent.
Why would Hungary want to gain influence in Africa?
Yeah, there are some experts that believe that, you know, because Hungary has such close ties to the Kremlin, that this deal is really to further Russia's interests in the Sahel. I would argue that probably Viktor Orban is sort of hoping to develop Hungary as a regional foreign power in Africa. Hungary sought a similar military deal with Niger until a July 2023 coup sort of scuppered that, you know, wrecked Orban's plans. And now it's striking the same deal with Chad.
What sort of resources does Chad have that Hungary wants?
Chad is rich in critical minerals. It's rich in lithium. It's rich in gold. Some experts believe that Hungary would be interested in. But I also think it is about securing this influence, securing this footprint in the Sahel. Chad is at a very sort of strategic location in where it is within the Sahel. It's right at the crossroad between northwest and central Africa. It's close to Egypt. It's close to Nigeria. It's close to Niger. So all of these sort of, if you want to achieve any kind of strategic power on the continent, Chad is the best place to do that, hence why so many foreign powers have their soldiers stationed in Chad.
France, which has been reducing its influence in the Sahel, still has at least 1,000 or so soldiers in Chad. But as you say, there are so many other foreign powers that have troops in that part of the region, part of Africa. So it's kind of quite a crowded neighborhood. Why does Hungary want to carve out its niche in such a crowded field?
If you want to achieve big influence in Africa, Chad is really the best place to do that, mainly because of its strategic location, but also because it has so many internal power rivalries going on within its military, that Idriss Deby is fighting rebels, not only within his leadership, but from all fronts. And therefore, he is looking for all of these allies to sort of secure his own position. And therefore, it's the easiest country to achieve that influence with.
Why would Chad be doing this?
Hungary sending troops to Chad, well, planning to send troops to Chad, was under the invitation of Idriss Deby himself. He asked the Hungarian leadership about it last year in October. And essentially, he is trying to legitimize and secure his own leadership. He is somebody that came to power in not a legitimate way. yes, he won elections that were held in May, but there were no other sort of serious opponents that were allowed to run against him. He took power previously from his late autocratic father, who himself seized power in a coup.
So Idris Deby's son is trying to legitimize himself. Viktor Orban is looking to establish a foothold on the continent. Why Hungary, though, for Chad?
Chad is more interested in ensuring that he has the military leadership has as many allies as possible from the West in order to keep Deby in power and to secure his position. Last year, US intelligence warned Chad that Chadian rebels were looking to attempt a coup. These were Chadian rebels based in the Central African Republic. Since then, he's fostered relationship with Vladimir Putin. He is renegotiating terms with the US on its troops. It's kept. It's one of the few, it's actually the last country in the Sahel to still have French troops stationed in the country. So this is essentially part of his sort of balancing act in terms of getting as much support as possible.
It's an interesting move, don't you think, given that Viktor Orban and Hungary, you won't necessarily consider them to be part of the West almost, even though they are in the EU. They've very definitely been at odds with other members of the EU by their close ties with Russia. And of course, I mean, Donald Trump did tell the world recently that Viktor Orban likes him and admires him. But I'm not sure that Viktor Orban is that popular in other EU centres.
You know, Hungary, let's not forget, is a part of NATO. So it is still, although small and unlikely to achieve any kind of major security, it's unlikely to make an impact within Chad itself. But it is part of NATO and it is still a significant ally to have in terms of putting all your ducks in one row and making sure that you're spreading your allies as widely as possible.
Nosmot Badamosi, Africa brief writer for Foreign Policy magazine. Focus on Africa was put together by Blessing Aderogba in Lagos, Charles Kitonga in Nairobi, and Rob Wilson, Patricia Whitehorn, and Bella Hassan here in London. Francesca Dunn was our technical producer. Paul Bajibinga, our senior producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
Rising temperatures,
the extreme weather, melting ice,
they're all interconnected.
How can we solve this?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring why we find it so hard to save our own planet.
We have many of the tools that we need.
And how we might change that.
If we do smart things right now, we can take care of our descendants.
It is a question of awareness, it is a question of information and access to that information.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
It is based on experience and it is based on science.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.